Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama on the defensive about minor officials in the IRS targeting Tea Party and other patriot groups. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist with the Los Angeles Times, Michael Hiltzik, joins us to discuss his article in the LA Times, The Real IRS Scandal, and whether it is more of a case of the IRS doing too little as opposed to too much in going after flagrantly political groups applying for tax exemption in the name of social welfare. Then, with the Tea Party claiming political victimhood, we will analyze the real nature of the Tea Party movement with Chris Parker, the author of a new book, Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. We will discuss his thoroughly researched study of the Tea Party that presents itself as a new revolutionary phenomenon when in fact it is the old reactionary right repackaged as a grassroots movement. With its funding from billionaires, it is much more the heir of the Know-Nothing Party, the Ku Klux Klan, and the John Birch Society than those who inspired the American Revolution. Then finally, with the phony scandal overwhelming important substance, we will look further into the recent breaching of the threshold of 400 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere and speak with Michael Mann, the co-founder and award-winning science, the co-founder of the award-winning science website realclimate.org, who shared a Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. We will discuss the need for aggressive leadership to slap down the deniers and take urgent action to save the planet before we pass the point of no return. I'm now joined by Michael Hiltzik, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist with the Los Angeles Times, who received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing the corruption in the entertainment industry. Currently, he writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, covering business and economic issues relevant to life in California. His books include The Plot Against Social Security, Dealers of Lightning, Xerox PARC, and The Dawn of the Computer Age, A Death in Kenya, and his most recent Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century. His latest article at the Los Angeles Times is The Real IRS Scandal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hiltzik.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And of course, the president is appearing with the Turkish Prime Minister today at the White House, was barraged by questions about the IRS and the extent to which they targeted the Tea Party. And he's on the defensive, and I wonder why he is being so defensive and why he took a defensive stand immediately when it might well have been a good opportunity for him to talk about the real issue, which is what you've written about in your article, and that is the flood of money that's come into the political process since Citizens United and this rubric under which they get tax exemption as for social welfare, as though they're charitable, when it's clear that they're flagrantly political. So, is the president missing an opportunity here, and in effect, taking too much blame for something that minor officials in the IRS were responsible for?
Right. Well, I think he certainly is missing an opportunity, and in fact, progressives in Congress are missing an opportunity. I think probably the president and the White House are making a calculation that there's no percentage in defending the IRS on anything, because it's such a detested agency for any number of reasons that we don't have to go into. But as I pointed out, the real scandal here is that the IRS, first of all, that the IRS has not done really anything to rein in what essentially is subterfuge by organizations that claim to be social welfare organizations. I mean, classically, typically, these are volunteer fire departments and educational foundations and homeowner groups, literacy organizations. That's what a C4, which is the designation we're talking about, typically was. Since Citizens United, there's been this flood of applications from all sorts of overtly political organizations. And it's not merely that they want the tax exemption. I think that's minor. What they really want is something that C4s get that's more valuable than gold to a political donor, and that is anonymity. C4 organizations don't have to disclose their donors. That's what these organizations are offering to political activists, political owners, political agents on all sides of the aisle. And I think that's really what has to be reined in here.
So as you pointed out in your article, Michael Hiltzig, the real IRS scandal, that in the state of California, there was a mysterious $11 million donation to a campaign for California's anti-union Proposition 32 last November. And if it wasn't for the State Fair Political Practices Commission exposing the anonymous donors of who were hiding behind these 501c4 organizations, we wouldn't have known about who was really behind it. Now, if the state of California can puncture the anonymity, why can't the IRS?
Well, in fact, the state of California hasn't actually gotten to the bottom of who those donors are for this very reason, and that is that the C4 organizations don't have to, can conceal the names of their donors. I think what the Fair Political Practices Commission was able to do was identify that there were these C4s behind the $11 million donation. Other than that, we would have had no idea even what organizations had made the donation. So you can see how bad this problem is. I think California has always been a bellwether of this because so much money comes into the state for initiative campaigns, and it's always been a battle to make sure that the names are disclosed. This was a case where I think they're working toward it. They're still investigating, but we still don't know what individuals put up that money, and that's the flaw in the federal system.
So is there any, at this point, do we really know the extent to which the IRS really, in any great way, in any systemic way, really did anything wrong? Obviously, as you pointed out, they're the least popular agency around, and nobody much wants to defend them. But if you're getting flooded with these applications, most of which are coming from the Republican side or from Republican front groups, and you're trying to do some kind of triage, it sort of makes sense to try and, screen them out. And it seems to me that the problem here is not that the IRS did something illegal. The problem is that what is legal is wrong.
That's right. I think if you look at the Inspector General's report, which was just released yesterday, and this is the investigation of what went on at this unit that was supposed to be examining these applications, I think it says very specifically that these groups were not selected because of their political coloration. This unit of overworked rank-and-file workers in the Cincinnati office of the IRS that was tasked with the responsibility of examining this flood of C4 applications, and the number of applications had doubled in the 2 or 3 years since Citizens United, and clearly the workers said, how can we get our arms around this so that we don't have to look at every one? And they put out a screen. They said, well, we know that the Tea Party is filing a lot of these. We know that a lot of them have names like Patriot. So why don't we use that as a screen, and we'll see what comes up. What the Inspector General report found is that they ended up with 300 organizations to give closer scrutiny to, but only a third of those fell into this category of Tea Party or Patriot or 912. We don't know what the other two-thirds were, but there's every possibility that they were liberal groups or Democratic groups or progressive groups because they were also trying to exploit this C4 loophole. And the fact of the matter is that none of these organizations actually was denied a C4 designation. The only group we know of that didn't get that got revoked, the C4 organization, was a group that was registering Democratic voters in Maine. Clearly, not the right wing victims that the right wing likes to claim. So I think what the IG clearly concluded is that this was an unwise and sure inappropriate, but not overtly political attempt, simply to find a way to get at the problem as fast as possible. And it also points out that the moment managers at the IRS discovered that they were using the screen, they were told, stop it, find something broader, more neutral, and do it that way. And eventually they did. By the beginning of 2012, they were using what I thought to be a fairly neutral screen.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Hilzik, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist with the Los Angeles Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1999 for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry, and he currently writes the twice-weekly column Golden State. He is the author of Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century, and his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is The Real IRS Scandal. So could they have come up with a regime, Michael Hilzik, that would have, for example, gone after Karl Rove? It seems like he was the first to use the 501c4 in a big way. He started Crossroads and then found Crossroads GPS, which was the offered anonymity because it was a C4. And I believe most of the money that he raised went through that C4 because that is the preferred vehicle of people. You know, if you're a corporate CEO, you don't want to put your corporation in jeopardy because maybe half your customers are Democrats and half are Republicans. But this gives you the shield behind which you can you know, practice your politics as opposed to your shareholders' politics.
Right. Well, I'm not sure they needed a screen to go after Crossroads GPS because everybody knew that Crossroads had set up this C4. I think one of the ironies of this whole affair is that it's these big C4s that didn't get examined very closely by the IRS. This group in Cincinnati was essentially looking at sort of small-time grifters, these small-time tea parties who had, no qualifications to be designated C4, but were taking advantage of this loophole. The big guys were skating through, and that's still the condition we're at. And one of the dangers in this whole incident is that the IRS is going to be scared away from taking a close look at any C4s because it now looks so politically explosive, and clearly that's the point we have to be at. I mean, the rules should be, and in fact, in the Citizens United decision, Justice Anthony Kennedy, who wrote that decision, said we need to have disclosure of all of this corporate money that we are, through this decision, going to let into the political process. Well, we have less disclosure today than we did in the 1990s. We're down to 40% of donations are disclosed. That's what Congress really has to do, is enact a law that says if you are contributing to elections, if you are intervening in campaigns, all of your donations, no matter what your designation is, have to be disclosed publicly.
Well, I think, Michael Hilzik, there's a broader problem here that this does identify, and that is that not only has our political system been dominated by money, a lot of which is anonymous, the regulatory system is being captured, and all of these regulatory agencies are compromised by political leverage from the very same people who make these donations. Somehow they're able to get to intimidate these agencies into not doing their job. You just brought up the idea that a shareholder doesn't, a CEO can give money anonymously through a C4 and not offend half of his customers who may belong to the opposite party to the one that he's supporting. The SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, is now looking at a way that they have the ability, the oversight ability, to force CEOs to report to their shareholders where they give their political donations to. The FCC has the ability to force media, and particularly television, to reveal who the money is behind the ads that are really the main vehicle by which people get elected. So there's an awful lot of stuff out there that can be done by these regulatory agencies, but they simply aren't doing it.
Well, that's true. And I think there's an argument to be made that the Internal Revenue Service is probably the wrong agency to be tasked with this particular issue, which is determining whether an organization is a political organization or not. It doesn't have guidelines. It's simply not equipped to do that sort of oversight. But we do have a Federal Election Commission. That's an agency that really should be encouraged to be aggressive about all these things. And we need laws mandating disclosure under all circumstances. And we need to have a regulatory agency that's relatively immune from the sort of pressure that they're inevitably going to get from Congress. Because, look, members of Congress are politicians. They enjoy the money that comes in anonymously. They want it to continue to flow. they should be shamed into changing the law so that it's not secret anymore. And then it should be a legitimate regulatory agency, not a collection agency like the IRS, that's given the responsibility to make sure that that happens.
Well, Michael Hiltzik, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Hiltzik, who's a professor, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist with the Los Angeles Times, who received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry. Currently, he writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, covering business and economic issues in California, and his books include The Plot Against Social Security, A Death in Kenya, and Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century. His latest article at the LA Times is The Real IRS Scandal. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the Tea Party now claiming political victimhood.
Explain and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in our game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He is the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington and the author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book, just out, is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Parker.
Thank you, Ian. I'm honored to be here.
And clearly the IRS is on the defensive, and so is the White House, by the way, today in the press conference with the Turkish Prime Minister. The president once again went after the IRS and said how terrible it is, and we have to be completely nonpartisan at the IRS. And, of course, the acting head has been fired or is obviously stepped down under fire. It's a bit hard to understand why the president is being so defensive at this point when, in fact, he could turn the whole thing around by pointing out that the IRS, in fact, hasn't done its job. It wasn't if they were doing too much, they were doing too little. These 501c4s have opened the floodgates for anonymous billionaires to pour millions and billions into our elections. And the IRS basically, 90% of the applications have come from right-wing groups. So, you know, obviously they should have gone after Karl Rove, but I don't see the problem. Do you?
No, well, there is a slight problem in that, yes. I mean, it should be, the IRS should be, you know, politics-free. However, and it's a big however, the IRS went after the NAACP in 2004. Because Julian Bond, the chairman at the time, he's now chairman emeritus, you know, spoke out against Bush policies, the war, the economy, and, you know, so on and so forth, right? So, you know, most people get audited, you know, after the IRS receives their taxes, but they got audited in October, which is an odd time. So there's one example. Let me just call forth a couple other figures I think the listeners may be interested in. The first of which is there are about 296 potential political cases the IRS ended up with. That is to say, cases from the far right. Do you know how many were denied? I'm just going to ask you just a guess. I'll give you one educated guess. How many were denied?
Probably two.
No, zero.
There you go.
Zero.
Right.
Were denied, right? So there are 108 approved, 28 cases in which the application was withdrawn by the applicant, and there are 160 cases that are now pending. Now, I will hazard a guess that those will go through scot-free, given the current political climate.
Well, but I don't understand, and I'm certainly not defending the politicization of the IRS, because I think it, and we know that it started, at least the ones that I can remember were back in the Nixon days. He used the IRS against his political enemies, and nobody would defend that kind of behavior. But as an institution that are trying to fund the United States government, most of the anti-government activity in this country, the hatred of the government, the paranoia about the government, and the defiance against paying taxes for this evil government, they all repose in the far right, do they not?
Yes. So let me elaborate on that a little bit. Now, it's just my supposition here. I have done a little bit of research, but it's my supposition here that not only do these people just generally don't like government necessarily, but because you have a black man who is the head of government, that's an even bigger problem for them. So when we're talking about taxes, it's not just, you know, the state is redistributing my hard-earned money. It's this black man who has his hand in my pocket and who plans on redistributing it to black and brown people. So that it adds a little bit more impetus and urgency to their cause.
And your book, Chris Parker, Change They Can't Believe In, the brand new book that's just out here with co-author Matt Barreto, I guess makes the case that the Tea Party is not a revolutionary party, as it's been largely portrayed as in a benign way by both the left and the right-wing press, I would argue, going back to the idea that their roots come out of the outrage over the bailout on Wall Street, which for reasons that still mystify me, the political left in this country did not seize upon. But that's another argument. But I'm saying that what I get out of your new book is that the Tea Party is not a revolutionary party. It's a reactionary party.
Yes, that is very much so the case. So first of all, you know, some people want to make this argument, and I run into them all the time. Oh, yeah, the Tea Party, you know, they hated Bush, too. It's like the Tea Party did not exist on Bush's watch, right? It did not exist at all. Okay, let me just give you a few facts and figures about Bush, right? When we start talking about the deficit, for example, it expanded more than any other time in history. Oh, and we just found out this morning that the deficit has decreased. So projected decrease by $200 billion, right? We found that out this morning, right? So let me throw that on the table. Moreover, the increase in discretionary spending increased by a total of 49% on Bush's watch. Even if you compare Bush to Clinton, right, and looking at the federal government, on Clinton's watch, the federal government increased by 11%. On Bush's watch, it increased by 104%. Bush entered office with a $700 billion surplus, thanks to Clinton. He departed with a $1.3 billion deficit, which constitutes a $2 billion swing. TARP was initiated on Bush's watch, $700 billion bailout to GM, AIG, and Citigroup. So if conservatives were so upset, and the Tea Party claimed that they're really all about fiscal matters and small government, I ask you, where were they on Bush's watch?
Well, that's the point, though, isn't it? That, again, the point that you make in your new book, Change They Can't Believe In, Christopher Parker, co-authored with Matt Barreto, is that the Tea Party is just a repackaging of the far right in this country. You go back to the Know-Nothings, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s, and, as you just mentioned, the John Birch Society. I think that's a part of the brilliance of the Kochs and others, is that they managed to make this look like it is something new when it is, in fact, something old and perpetually noxious.
Yeah, this sort of reactionary conservatism has been around for a very long time, as you mentioned. We tie it to the Know-Nothing Party of the 1850s, to the Klan of the 1920s, to the John Birch Society, and obviously to the Tea Party now. And what they all have in common is their definition of what a quote-unquote real American is, generally white, male, middle class and wealthier, older, Protestant, heterosexual. This is who the and it's riven, the social science literature is riven with this description, right? Both empirically and sort of thematically, right? That is who the real American is. And every time there's a threat, a possible sustained threat to this, you get one of these far-right reactionary movements that comes around because it's a reaction to what they perceive as rapid social change and that their America is being stolen from them, pilfered from them.
Well, but it seems to me, and I think in many ways, Ronald Reagan, you know, and he's the darling of every conservative in this country, he appealed to that atavistic Ossie and Harriet, June Cleaver era of black and white television that was really unreal to begin with. The only reason that we had white America then living this perfect American dream was that blacks and Hispanics were invisible. They were there, but they weren't shown. And what's happened since is that the rest of America, the other real Americans, they've gradually stepped out of the shadows. And is that what they can't deal with?
Yeah, it's that, but it's what Obama represents, right? Think about who the president is, you know, in American political life. We know, research has shown, we know who the president is from the time we're a little kid. The president is an authority figure in our lives from the time we're little kids, right? He is not only the head of government, but the face of America, you know, beyond our shores, internationally. And so for a lot of people, for most of us, especially as we move into adulthood, our identity becomes connected to the presidency, because the presidency represents us all, right? So what happens then if you have someone in that position who no longer looks like you, right? It makes you paranoid. It makes you a little nervous that the commander-in-chief of the military is no longer a white man, right? The chief law enforcement officer is no longer a white man, right? The face of America is no longer a white man, right? That is a powerful symbol to these folks.
But what explains though, Chris Parker? What explains why conservative America is happy with Condoleezza Rice, with Colin Powell, and they've got this surgeon, I can't remember his name now, this is the new champion of
Ben Carson.
There you go, yeah. So these people, and you got Clarence Thomas, for God's sake, on the Supreme Court. So
yeah, but I don't think they, people really consider him to be black. But anyway, that's a different case.
Right, but if you could give me some insight into why it is that Obama scares the hell out of them and Ben Carson is a hero.
Okay, so let me clarify this. Let's make a distinction between more mainstream moderate conservatives and reactionary conservatives, right? Mm-hmm. So one distinction is that more moderate mainstream conservatives, when you think about these people, if you think about them like back in the 60s when we really started having, when we had this split in conservatives or in the Republican Party, so you had Rockefeller, you had Mitt Romney's daddy, Nixon, on one side, right? And then you had Barry Goldwater on the other side. Right. And so you have these more moderate mainstream conservatives. I mean, think about if we think about what conservatives and Republicans did in the 1960s. Right. You had more Republicans vote for civil rights legislation than you did Democrats. So let's get that out there right now. There are different types of conservatives. Right. So more moderate conservative does not necessarily embrace change, does not necessarily want change, but they'd rather have they'd rather have evolutionary organic change versus revolutionary change, right? I mean, Edmund Burke wrote about this, you know, regarding the French Revolution, right? And then you have, and so they understand change is necessary. When you look at these reactionary conservatives, they don't brook any kind of change whatsoever. They actually want to go back in time. Moderate conservatives, they're okay with moving forward incrementally. These folks, these reactionary conservatives, they want to look back in time. They see social change as subversion of their social prestige. And so we have to go backwards in time. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. So let me answer your question, though, more directly. So why are they okay with, let's say, Condoleezza Rice?
How about Herman Cain? That's a better example.
Okay. They're more comfortable. You know, this is not going to be the most politically correct answer. Just so I want you guys to know that I'm black too, so I think I got a little room to run with here. Herman Cain is one of those quote unquote black folks who says and does all the right things and stays in his place. He's a known quantity, right? He's tied to the United States. Same thing with Colin Powell. One of the reasons why, you know, people are upset with Colin Powell now is that he won't stay in his quote-unquote place. Right? Now he says what he thinks. And so he's sort of alienated from the Republican Party. As a matter of fact, he's on record as saying, I didn't leave the Republican Party. The Republican Party left me.
Sure, and he voted for Obama twice. So.
Yes, and he voted for Obama twice. Condoleezza Rice, I mean, she was on, you know, she was on Bush's, she was in Bush's cabinet. And she did everything that Bush asked him to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, I'm saying that these people, if you think about Colin Powell back in the day, if you think about Condoleezza Rice, if you think about Herman Cain, these are quote-unquote exceptional black folk and that they are not recognized as being black because they align their political beliefs with the right, right? At least Colin Powell, not anymore, right? But they're quote-unquote, they're okay as far as black folks go. They're the exceptional black folks who don't act like all the rest of the black folks. Now, for Obama, you know, first of all, he has roots in Kenya, right? His father was a Kenyan national, right? And so they see him as a sort of Manchurian candidate. In other words, the reason why they're so scared of Obama, one of the reasons is because they don't really know much about him. Number one, right? Number two, they have to gin up this paranoia in order to make this a battle of, as false as it is, between good and evil. They see him and everything he represents as evil. And what I mean, everything he represents, look at what's happened to same-sex rights since he's been in office. They've gotten better, right? Look at what's happening to immigration reform. He gets in office. I know that was on the table in 2007. It was gone. He gets in office. He makes that a priority now in his second term because, quite frankly, Obamacare sucked up all the political oxygen when that went through. But now it's a priority, right? So you look at these groups who would be considered un-American, you know, gays and lesbians, Latinos, right? And it doesn't make a difference if they're natural born or illegal. They're both looked at in the same light, right? These groups' stature has risen collectively, right? But these are putative un-American or non-Americans as far as the phenotype is concerned.
Well,
so that's why we get these differences.
I see. So just in closing, Chris Parker, tell us about why you wrote the book, one, and two, and why people need to read it.
Happy to do so, Lena. Thank you once again for the opportunity. I wrote it because, I mean, I really wasn't going to write another book. I had just, you know, received a major award for my first book in 2010, and then I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And let me tell you what happened, Ian. So I put a survey in the field in early 2010 as a post-tenure project because my next book, the book actually I'm working on right now, is on patriotism. And I think you guys will like the way that's going to end up, too. But anyway, so it was intended to capture attitudes and beliefs towards patriotism. And by my colleague Matt's suggestion, he said, hey, man, why don't you just throw a question about the Tea Party on there? And I was like, okay. And that's what I did. So one day I'm sitting around with my dog Daisy, and I'm reading the New York Times and what Frank Rich is saying about, you know, them being, you know, just angry and mean and spiteful and kind of crazy, right? And then in the next couple of days, I read a piece by Peggy Noonan and a piece by Juan Williams in the Wall Street Journal who are saying the exact opposite, saying they're just angry, but they're just like everybody else. And so I'm like, you know what? I got data on this. Let me go check this out. And that's where it all started. That's where it all started because I tried to get an empirical handle on this, and no matter what I tried to do, right, methodologically, the connection between support for the Tea Party and these racist, these homophobic, these xenophobic, and these sexist attitudes continue to come together and they maintain themselves. And so I had to go deeper and get more sophisticated statistically, and relationships maintain themselves. And so that's what I had to do. So I felt like I had to write it at that point. Not only that, Ian, I had traveled with my then wife to Lanai. Now, if anybody who's traveled to Hawaii knows that Lanai is perhaps the most remote island. You got two restaurants on that whole island, right? We just happened to be sitting at a table, unbeknownst to us, of Tea Party people, and they start in on me. Where did Obama come from? Is he real, right? Or is he fake or what? And I used to run into people like that all the time at the airport, Ian, or if I'm just at a restaurant. And I just said, you know what? I really got to finish this book. So they continued to motivate me. So that's number one. So that's why I wrote the book. Why I think folks should buy the book, I think it because, like I said, it is the most rigorous examination of the Tea Party to date, and that will probably ever be. I do and my colleague do as much as we can to falsify our arguments, right? To say that, okay, maybe this isn't true. Maybe there are competing explanations for what we're finding, like conservatism, party ID, authoritarianism, and so on and so forth. But it's not there. There's always this relationship between Tea Party support and these intolerant attitudes towards the president, towards sexual minorities, towards racial minorities, right? It's all there. And so this will be, and it's written in a very accessible fashion. So one does not have to be statistically literate to understand what's happening in the book, because we put all the fancy tables and charts in the appendix in the back of the book. So the sophisticated lay reader will understand everything that's going on. So you're going to get the latest and best research on the Tea Party, and I doubt that anyone else will surpass this anytime soon.
Well, Chris Parker, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian. Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity.
Again, I'm speaking with Chris Parker, who's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He is the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics, director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington, and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book, just out, co-written with Matt Barreto, is Change They Can't Believe In, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the most important story on the planet that's being overwhelmed at the moment by phony scandal. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He is a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to be with you.
And last week, there was an extraordinarily important story that came out as a result of instrument readings in the middle of the Pacific Ocean on the top of the volcano on the Big Island of Hawaii that indicate that the atmospheric CO2 concentration has surpassed 400 parts per million. And this milestone, of course, here we are about a week later, and it's all but forgotten. All the press are going on about is this incredibly fictional Benghazi story, the absurd overkill against the IRS, who can actually be accused of not doing their job in terms of all the money that's pouring into politics. And, of course, Eric Holder being beaten up and everybody saying now Obama's finished. But, hey, wait a minute. Is the planet finished? What are we talking about here?
Well, you know, it is unfortunate that a story this important sort of disappears, into the 24/7 news cycle in a matter of a day or two. And this is an extreme development, the fact that we've reached 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. Pre-industrial levels were about 286 parts per million. We've already raised them to 400 now. We are fairly confident that you probably have to go back at least 4 million years and perhaps as long as 10 million years to find a time in the Earth's past when CO2 concentrations were as high as they are now. This is the highest CO2 concentration we've seen in the history of human civilization.
And, of course, the nature of it, since it's being generated and it takes a while to get that concentrated in the atmosphere, there's more in the pipeline.
Right. We're not just plateauing at 400. We're shooting straight past it, and we're well on our way to 450 parts per million. We'll be there in a matter of decades if we continue with business as usual. Now, why is that important? Well, 450 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere is the concentration that we're fairly confident commits us to at least 2 degrees Celsius, that's almost 4 degrees Fahrenheit, warming of the globe relative to pre-industrial time. When climate scientists look at the projected impacts of climate change, it's often that figure is often pointed to as where we start to cross the threshold of truly dangerous and irreversible changes in our climate.
Well, it's clear that, as I mentioned, that the president is distracted. But doesn't this require some serious leadership to point out how alarming this situation is? And yesterday I covered an interesting story that's coming out of the International Energy Agency that just released a report saying that there's been a global tectonic shift in the world energy markets, where the United States will surpass Russia in 2015, which is only a couple of years away, in terms of being the world's biggest producer of gas. This is because of the fracking that's going on.
Right.
And that the U.S. will become energy self-sufficient very soon, and it'll move within a decade from a net importer to a net exporter. And clearly, this is a big story. So why is it not that the president is using this as a way, you know, get a plan going, get a Manhattan Project going, get a man on the moon thing going, instead of being on the defensive all the time?
Well, yeah, you know, he, you know, in recent months, you know, since his reelection to a second term, the president often has been more forceful in the language that he's used to characterize the threat of climate change, and he's been more willing to call out climate change deniers. In fact, he just tweeted yesterday calling them out for basically trying to prevent the approval of the new EPA administrator, Gina McCarthy. So, you know, the president, I think, is trying to do what he can to both to speak out about the issue. And within the administration, you know, they've been taking actions, the EPA, in sort of tightening restrictions on coal-fired power plants. They are trying to do what they can, but obviously, in order to pass a climate bill, we need, you know, a Congress that is willing to engage in good faith efforts to deal with this problem. And frankly, right now, we have a Congress, a House of Representatives, where the Science Committee, the House Science Committee, is led by somebody who denies that climate change is even real. And how can we have that important debate that we need to have about how to solve the problem if we can't even admit that the problem exists? And so with the current congressional makeup, it's difficult to see how a climate bill gets passed. What that probably means is that we'll need to see a change in the congressional makeup. You know, if we are going to pass legislation to deal with this problem, meanwhile, the president has to do everything he can from the executive side to try to deal with our carbon emissions.
Again, I speak with Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's the co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website, realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Well, I'm not meaning here, Michael, to put everything on Obama's shoulders here. In fact, when you just pointed out the know-nothing that runs the Science Committee on the Republican chair of the Science Committee, I think the real point here is that why do we as a country and a culture, and particularly our press, tolerate such flagrant and irresponsible ignorance? And why do we not call these buffoons out for their idiotic anti-intellectualism. I mean, we don't have time for this nonsense of balance, you know, fair and balanced, for God's sake. What the fair and balanced binary notion in our press has done, it's allowed the Koch brothers and the climate deniers to equate their non-science with real science for equal and opposite arguments. It's allowed the creationists to say that they're just the other argument up against evolution. I mean, you know, this is the thing that's driving me nuts, is that why do we pussyfoot around people like these know-nothings in Congress? I mean, and of course, in the Senate, you've got Imhoff, who's a proud denier. They should be pilloried. They should be put in the stocks, for God's sake, not treated as reasonable human beings and important lawmakers.
Well, you know, we are faced, for example, with the prospect right now of the Koch brothers purchasing the L.A. Times. If you've been reading the headlines recently, the Koch brothers are trying to buy the Tribune newspaper syndicate. And if they are successful in doing that, it means that we will have, you know, even fewer independent voices within the media to cover this issue with, you know, objectivity and accuracy, right? Because objectivity and accuracy trumps balance when it comes to good journalism. And it's important for there to be reasonable balance, for reasonable viewpoints of both sides to be represented in the discussion. But the foremost responsibility of a journalist is to report accurately and objectively. And I feel like we've regressed in the way that we cover matters of policy relevant science. You know, there was this famous quote attributed to Patrick Moynihan, the former New York senator: "You're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts." And we've entered into a realm now in our public discourse on climate change and an array of issues, where many feel that they're entitled to their own facts. And, you know, there's a whole cable network, you know, that is willing to report things, you know, to provide an alternative universe where the laws of physics don't apply anymore, and where science is no longer represented accurately. That's a real challenge to have, you know, the sort of debate we need to have about the policy matters involved, what to do about the problem, when, you know, people increasingly can sort of isolate themselves into a bubble of disinformation. They can, you know, get all of their information from sources that are not willing to cover this issue from a factually based perspective. It's a problem.
Well, I mentioned, Michael Mann, the revolution that's taking place in the global energy markets as the U.S. In a couple of years surpasses Russia to become the world's biggest supplier of gas, most of which will be domestic, most of which will go into power generation and perhaps into fleets of trucks, etc., and even cars. I mean, in other countries like Australia, you can go to the gas station and you can get natural gas alongside gasoline. It's a lot cheaper, and it pollutes, I think, 50% less in terms of global warming. I'm not suggesting it's a panacea, but at least it's a step in the right direction. But here we have, in Los Angeles, you got Al Gore and Villaraigosa, outgoing mayor, congratulating themselves over the fact that they're closing down the coal-fired plant in the Mojave that supplies much of Southern California's electricity.
Right.
But they're not going to do that for 15 more years. We don't have 15 years. We don't have any time. The latest figures indicate we're past the point where we should be dealing with this.
Right. You know, if we look at the current CO2 concentration, which we were talking about earlier, 400 parts per million, as I said, you've got to go back 4 million years to find CO2 concentrations we know were that high in the past. And we also know that at that time, the globe was several degrees warmer than it is right now. Sea level was about 100 feet higher than it is right now. So even if we were to keep CO2 sustained at the current level, we could easily commit ourselves to dangerous and irreversible changes in the climate. So the fact is that there's already potentially too much carbon in the atmosphere, and simply, you know, transitioning from one fossil fuel to another fossil fuel, it isn't going to solve the problem. It's true that nominally natural gas produces about 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions that coal burning does, although there are some uncertainties, there are some caveats, because some of the natural gas leaks into the atmosphere during the process of natural gas recovery. And natural gas itself is, you know, primarily methane. It's also a powerful greenhouse gas. So that's an important caveat. We still don't have, you know, firm measurements of that effect. Now, the fact is that just transitioning from one fossil fuel to another fossil fuel doesn't accomplish what we need to do, as you've alluded to. We need to actually bring our emissions to a peak and ramp them down dramatically if we are going to avoid crossing the next critical threshold. We've already crossed 400. We're well on our way to 450 ppm. And when we pass 450 ppm, the model projections tell us that's when we really start to see the worst effects of climate change kick in.
So is that what it's going to take, though, for us to literally see vast areas of the globe underwater before we wake up? I mean, give us a sense of how quickly this bubble of denial, as we continue our lifestyle and our carbon-based lifestyle, if you will, and at what point do we as a species realize that we have basically blown it here on this planet?
Well, that's the problem. The problem is that we have already put enough warming into the pipeline that it's possible that we've already committed to the melting of a large part of the major ice sheets, the Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheet, enough to give us, you know, 5-6 meters ultimately of sea level rise. Now, it may take centuries for that to play out, because the processes involved are slow. But that means that the emissions that we are, you know, producing right now may already be pushing us past the threshold where we cross the point of no return, where we are committed to that amount of sea level rise. That's the problem with, you know, climate change and carbon emissions. There is this very long time scale involved in the response. There is what we call the committed warming. We, through our emissions right now, are creating changes that will take centuries to finally occur. That means that we can't see the full impact of what we're doing at the moment. It's the tip of the iceberg. All we see is the tip of the iceberg.
Well, but there's enough. I mean, even the Hurricane Sandy indicated that things had changed. I mean, you'd have to be
absolutely
totally unconscious not to notice that we've had these multiple traumatic weather events, and they're increasing in frequency and in damage.
Yeah, we know, for example, the most exhaustive economic analysis that's been done to date indicates that we are already losing worldwide about $1 trillion of GDP annually. That's about 2% of our gross domestic product is just being squandered because of the impacts, the negative impacts of climate change. And we've seen those impacts play out in a devastating way here in the U.S. over the last year. If you think back to last summer, the record heat and drought and the resulting wildfires out west, the precipitous decline in Arctic ice at the end of the summer, which we think influenced the atmosphere in a way that might have actually made Sandy more likely, that might have influenced the trajectory, the devastating trajectory that Superstorm Sandy took. Rather than sort of curving out into the open ocean, as most hurricanes do, it actually moved west towards the coast of New Jersey, New York City. So we have these reminders of the impact that climate change is already having. And like I said, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. We may be committing to far more devastating changes in the future if we don't turn things around within a few years. Now, the good news is that we do think there is still time to turn things around. We do think that we can avoid crossing that 450 parts per million threshold if we take action now. But there is a greater urgency than there has ever been before.
Well, just in closing, Michael Mann, it's difficult to understand why Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox, who are the big disinformation peddlers here, why he does what he does. I mean, we can just, you know, put it down to malevolence, because as a business model, it doesn't make any sense. But you understand why the Kochs do what they do, because they're in the oil business. And sure. They just want to make money, and they don't care about posterity. So we've got insurance companies out there who are losing money. You mentioned $1 trillion going out of GDP. So is there a possibility that there's going to be some powerful economic interests that'll step up and counter the Kochs and the Murdochs?
Sure. I mean, ultimately, I think we will see a battle of the, you know, of the titans, as it were, with the fossil fuel interests on the one side, but the insurance industry, the reinsurance industry, the national security community, because they are extremely worried about the national security threat associated with ongoing climate change. And, you know, you have other industries as well that can see that they are going to be negatively impacted by climate change. And that's not even taking into account the fact that, you know, ultimately corporations, you know, are led by CEOs who, you know, also have children and grandchildren. And one hopes that they're thinking about the legacy that they're leaving behind for, you know, the next generation. So I do hold out hope that we will, we will meet this challenge. The worry is that the disinformation campaign that's being waged by the Koch brothers and others and the Murdoch empire may delay action enough to where we already commit to far more devastating impacts than we would have if we had acted now. And so there's a real cost in the delay of action, and that is playing out right now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Mann.
Thank you. It's always good to talk with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Mann, who's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He is the co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.